It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever heard people talk to each other in online video games or played a game yourself with live conversation or maybe followed the chat on game streaming sites like Twitch, you may have seen how toxic those environments can be, especially for women, people of color, and the LGBTQ community. They can be even worse than social media comments on, say, Twitter or X or Facebook. It can look like an anything-goes situation, but there have been some efforts by companies to create safer gaming spaces. The game company Ubisoft recently introduced their own Good Game Playbook, which outlines what good online conduct looks like and how gamers can protect themselves from harassment. Others have various types of moderation and reporting systems. Our next guest studies online communities and what can be done to prevent harassment and create positive spaces in online gaming and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you play online games, or maybe do your kids? Do you follow game streamers? Have you witnessed or experienced harassment in those spaces? What kind of things would you like to see to create more friendly environments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Yvette Wan is an associate professor of informatics and director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Yvette, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, for people who haven't spent a lot of time in this world, whether playing, you know, live online games or following streamers on Twitch, can you give us a sense of some of the worst case? How bad can things get?
Well, we've talked to a lot of people who have been subject of these kind of harassment, and we've heard like really, really bad stories, including people who show up to people's houses in person because they somehow found their personal information. And then a lot of things that I don't feel comfortable talking on public radio, but it really ranges from, you know, the mild name calling to very serious situations.
That seems like the solutions I've seen over the years in a lot of online platforms is A, do nothing. I hope it kind of sorts itself out. B, having reporting and maybe blocking mechanisms, things like that. I was interested in this thing from Ubisoft. We've seen other similar things where they're trying to say, hey, instead of just focusing on reacting, we're going to try to set the ground rules for positive interaction online. What do you think of that approach?
I think that's something that scholars have been advocating for a very long time, because the analogy I like to make is a park. Like, if you go into a park and there's garbage everywhere, then people will probably think, oh, it's okay for me to throw away garbage here, right? But if it's like very clean and pristine, then you might think twice about, you know, just throwing garbage on the ground. And so I think that's the same with online communities. Like, depending on what you think is the norm of what should be happening there, I think that influences people's behaviors.
I want to look at some of your research now, Yvette. You focused on Twitch streams and how moderation works. Again, for people who haven't participated in this, can you talk about, so if I set up a Twitch stream, I play a video game of some sort, and then people can type into a chat along the way. Can you talk about what moderation looks like in that kind of chat?
Right. Twitch is very unique. Of course, it's not just for game streaming. Like, any kind of live streaming is possible on Twitch. And what is a little bit different from other social media is that things happen in real time. So as the person who is broadcasting is delivering whatever kind of content they're doing, in real time, you see the comments on the, you know, on one side of the screen, and it's like moving very fast because people are talking there. And so that poses a very interesting challenge, because what that means is that as things are happening, you need to be aware of what kind of comments are happening in real time. And it's a little bit different from like posting on an online forum, for example, where there's like a slight delay between when somebody posts and when somebody sees it. So it's not only like a social challenge, but also a technical challenge as well.
And have you seen successful approaches to that, as you say, real-time moderation?
So I think, things are definitely getting better. Like, even in the past few years, we've seen a lot of improvement. The moderation on Twitch or any kind of social media is a very complex process that not only involves like technical solutions such as like AI, but also real humans. And so we have actual human beings reading the comments and making decisions on the fly about whether those should be deleted or reported, or whether the person should be removed or given a warning. And so Twitch has a very interesting structure where each stream has its own moderators. So in some sense, the governance of the platform is very decentralized. And so each streamer needs to decide how it is that they want to run their channel.
We're talking to Yvette Wan from the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at moderation of online communities, especially often toxic chats or conversations in online gaming and game streaming. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences, maybe something you've seen yourself or your kid has encountered. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hey, Rob. This is actually a great idea for the show. I have seen this myself. I'm an avid gamer. I've played a lot of online games where people, the vitriol on it is insane. It goes from the mundane, a couple swears, to just racist, homophobic, and it is sad. But like your expert Yvette was saying, that it's getting better. I see that a lot of times they're able to do live banning or live censoring of words. And then also when it's up to the players themselves and the viewers to do the reporting, that it's getting taken care of. I personally play a mobile game that's like Call of Duty, and whenever someone gets reported, the developers are looking into it, and they're actually looking at chat logs, and they're looking at video replays, and they're making sure that these people aren't doing anything that's against the rules or anything that is not acceptable. And also it even goes further than just words and actions. It's more actions in game. If you're doing something that people don't like, they'll ban you for it. So it's
Michael,
getting better.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience. And Yvette, a few years ago, I know I'd heard from people saying, I don't even bother to report because I don't think anything is going to happen when I report. Is that, as Michael suggests, changing?
That's absolutely correct. I think the thing about content moderation is that companies are under no legal obligation to do this. And so for a very long time, they didn't do it because, you know, it takes a lot of money and resources to run that kind of program. But what they've realized over the years is that especially it's different now because a lot of games are online and social, right? As opposed to like 20, 30 years ago, where it was just like a person at home playing with their own computer. And so now they know that if they don't create a great environment, they're going to lose a lot of potential players.
Thanks again for that call, Michael. Yvette Wan is with us, Associate Professor of Informatics, Director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, talking about efforts to curb harassment in online gaming spaces and other online communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories, whether they're from this morning or from years ago, of bad experiences in online gaming communities? Or have you had positive experiences? Have you seen things change over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Yvette Wan, Associate Professor of Informatics, Director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at harassment and abuse in online gaming spaces and efforts by companies and users to try and make those spaces less toxic, more friendly. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Aiden is with us in Green Bay. Aiden, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So it's really interesting that you're talking about Ubisoft in particular, because I actually was just playing a game by them this morning. I was called For Honor. And the reason why I left this morning was because of some toxic behavior. Someone got on the mic and just started basically reciting things from Hitler's manifesto, basically. And I was curious what the speaker had to say about, there used to be a game, I don't remember what it's called, but it had a system basically where you got 1 point for every match, unless other people in the match uploaded you up to like 32, and it couldn't be your friends. And so what they use in this like system is basically every time you get a good behavior, you could get upvoted for it. And as a result, they had sort of like a more positive like community overall. But the thing is, that wasn't like a battle royale game where everyone was competing against each other. And so I was curious if she thought a system like that would work in some of like today's like service games, or if there's maybe a different way to go about it.
And thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, Yvette, that idea that he'd encountered in the past of positive reinforcement, I guess, if you behave well, people can vote for you, you get more experience points.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of game systems are incorporating more recently, and some of them are very overt, which means that you actually know what your reputation is based on the votes. And in other places, it's built into the algorithm, but you are not quite sure how it works because the company has not hidden those metrics from you. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of like dual strategies, right? Like there's the punishment, but there's also the positive reinforcement.
And then there's Aiden's experience. Just this morning, he said somebody reading Hitler quotes, it sounds like. Some moderation systems can have a lot of gray areas. I think that seems like a pretty cut and dried and easy one. If you report that, there's a good chance somebody would be blocked.
Right. I
would hope.
I hope so. Some things are very clear, and some things there's a lot of gray area. But another thing that I think Aiden mentioned that was really interesting is that this was like an audio situation, mm-hmm. right? When we look at like traditional text is very easy to monitor based on the technology that we have right now in artificial intelligence. So in some communities, for example, you can't even type out certain words. Like they won't even let you write it in because the system recognizes it as being toxic. But when we get to audio or behavioral things where, like, for example, you're moving around with your avatar in a certain way that is offensive, these are things that are harder for the computer to detect based on the technology we have today.
Thanks again for sharing that experience, Aiden. We'll go now to JJ in Two Rivers. JJ, hello.
Hello. So as an avid gamer, I see two double-edged swords in this topic. One being, anonymity is meant to protect victims, but it also then makes it difficult to punish people. The second double-edged sword is that just like domestic abuse laws, you know, these are rules and guidelines are meant to help, but they can also be abused and taken too far. You want to talk about those two double-edged swords.
JJ, thanks for the call. So that first point, Yvette, trying to protect people's anonymity online, he says could protect victims, but then it makes it harder to block the people who abuse the system. If somebody gets banned, they can maybe just come in under another identity, and it's hard to track that. Is this part of the challenge?
Absolutely. Between anonymity and real name is what we call pseudonymity, and that's when you operate under a single username, but people cannot connect that with your offline identity. But even if you have a system like that, people can always use different emails to create new accounts and repeat the same behavior, right? So there are some systems that are trying to take measures against that, which include kind of trying to find detect behavioral patterns, like to see if, you know, even if it's a different account, if people are acting similarly, to try to match that based on IP or other kind of activities that they're doing. There are also ways that, for example, if you've just created a new account, like you have to wait a certain time period before you can engage in certain ways. And so there are more efforts to try to detect this kind of multiple account behavior. At the same time, when we're talking to the actual moderators, the human moderators, the things that they say that I think are really meaningful are looking at educating people rather than just banning them. Because if we look at people who are violators, there's different categories. And some people are really out there to do harm and there's not much you can really do about it. But then there are often like very young people or people who are just kind of not knowing completely what is appropriate. And instead of just banning those people and having them, you know, create a different account, there's increasing efforts in trying to educate mm-hmm. them about, like, you know, what is appropriate.
Thanks for that call, JJ. And JJ's other point, the possibility that reporting systems can lead to a different kind of abuse. And I think I've heard of this, Yvette, where a group of trolls who wants to harass that someone will, as a group, report their target as the abuser, even though they hadn't done anything in the first place? Does that make it harder to create systems that work?
Absolutely, especially when you have anything that is like user-based comments or reporting. Anything for a good purpose could also be used for bad purposes, right? And we see a lot of, we just released a paper recently on hate raids, which is looking at coordinated attacks towards other people where, so Twitch has this function where if you have a lot of viewers, but you're ending your channel, you can send those viewers to another channel so that they can benefit from having more viewers. So that was like the good intention, but some people have been using this in a bad way, in which they send their viewers to a certain streamer to harass them. And so I think like with anything in technology, I think there's always going to be these double-edged swords, and we just need to figure out, you know, how to make the best in these different situations.
We're talking about online harassment in gaming and other forums, online chats, Twitch streams, and more. Yvette Wan is with us with the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at ways to create more positive experiences along the way. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Stephen is with us in Milwaukee. Stephen, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
I just want to say, like, I think it's also about, like, my son's 17, he does online gaming and stuff like that, and I play with sometimes too, but it's like, these people around you aren't real. And I told him, I was like, if someone says something offensive to you, just block them or leave. He's like, you have options. You don't have to, like, conform to, like, what's going on or be offended. Like, you can be upset for a second and be like, okay, this sucks. Then just get out or just block that player. Or these things exist in options. You can't just, like, they don't just, like, have these things where you're, like, you have to put up with this stuff.
Gotcha. Steven, thanks for the call. Yvette, Steven said a couple of things I want to get into. First of all, he talked to his son about how to respond when he encounters this. And that, as I understand it, Ubisoft and some other companies, part of their coaching is how to behave well. Part of it is how to engage or not engage when you do encounter harassment or abuse or racist messages or whatever online. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, depending on which game you're playing, there are also options where you can mute a certain person if they're being rude. So then even if they're saying things, like, you can't actually hear what they're saying. So that is one way to deal with it. Another thing, especially I recommend for people with like very young children or teenagers, is like suggesting that they play with friends rather than just playing with the general public at first, because again, like, you don't know who you're going to be playing with.
And then Stephen used the phrase also, these aren't real people. And I wonder if the abusers themselves, that's the mindset. Like, these are just things I'm encountering on the internet. Is that part of the goal of a positive training session, a positive message that, oh yeah, these are actual real people?
Yeah, I actually don't like to use the term like unreal for internet. And the reason for that is because what we perceive as reality, our brain isn't trained to say, oh, when I'm on the internet, this is not real. And when I'm offline, it's not real, especially for younger people, because technology and social media are embedded so much into their life. Whatever they do online is an extension of the reality. It's just taking place in a different venue. One nice way to think about it is, for example, like you at home and you at school, it's the same you, just in different environments, right? And so I think that, of course, it's easy to say, oh, you know, just, you know, brush it off because it's not anybody meaningful. But from the person who's hearing it, whether they hear it offline or online, it still has the same psychological impact and damage. So I think that it's important to understand that, like, what happens online, it's not unreal, right? It's very real. And in terms of your question regarding the violators, there are, like I said, there are a lot of different types of violators, and some people kind of view online as being, oh, this is, you know, a fictional scenario where I could do anything and get away with it, whereas other people don't make that distinction.
Thanks again for that call, Stephen. Christian joins us now in Eagle River. Oh, Christian just dropped off as we were going to take Christian. Yvette, I want to talk about who is most at risk, who is most targeted. I think again and again we see women, people of color, LGBTQ communities, particularly targets. How can we address that? How can we tackle that part of the problem?
I think one, like the best way to think about this is that online is not particularly different from offline. So if we think about all the people who are vulnerable offline, including all the populations that you mentioned, including children, these are the same people who are going to be at the same risk online as well.
And Yvette, are you hopeful as we wrap up that we can create not just not bad online community experiences, but good and positive online experiences in the gaming community and beyond?
I am hopeful. However, I do understand, like, you know, as people, there will never be a situation where there's nothing bad, right? Mm-hmm. However, I am hopeful that as more people become familiar with this new technology, that they will understand that, you know, this is not a separate place where you can do whatever you want. It is an extension of our physical reality. But I also think that kind of same with not just gaming, but like social media or other online activities in general, is that, you know, we can't completely just rely on companies to handle everything. And I think that, yes, companies should have a responsibility to do that. But I think also, you know, more education about, like, you know, how to conduct yourself online needs to be done at much earlier ages. And that's why I think we're also seeing a lot of improvement because, for example, like when I was in school, like I never learned about, like, you know, how to conduct myself online. But kids these days are receiving that kind of education. So I'm cautiously hopeful that in the future, people will see this as an extension of our physical reality and treat it with the respect that it deserves.
Yvette, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Yvette Wan, director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. We talked to her about efforts to curb harassment in online gaming spaces. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. School districts around the country are considering starting the school day later at middle and high school levels. That's because research shows that there are major health and educational benefits when teens get more sleep. Later, we'll talk to one of the leading researchers on school start times about the health and educational benefits of pushing back when that first bell rings. First, we're looking at start times in a Wisconsin school district and disruptions that have happened not because of sleep, but because of bus schedules. Our first guest is a local reporter who's been covering a mid-semester change to start and dismissal times in the Madison Metropolitan School District. The story is just one example in a wider context, but it illustrates some of the challenges to changing schedules at schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do school start and dismissal times affect you as a parent, a teacher, a student? If you remember your teen years, did school start too early? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott Girard is the K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Give us some background leading into this 2023-24 school year. What led to an effort to change start times for some schools?
Yeah, it really starts about 7 years ago. The district began exploring some of what you were talking about, the research on later start times benefiting especially older students like middle schoolers. After a couple years of research and community outreach, they had settled on a plan in 2018 to move middle school start times later. And so they began implementing that in fall 2019. Of course, later that school year, COVID-19 hit and disrupted everything around education, including implementation of that plan in the coming years. And so even once school returned in person in 2021 here in Madison, they weren't able to implement the plan as had been outlined. But this year, they had the opportunity to start a new bus contract and decided to continue implementation of that plan and move middle school start times later. So they began the year with that in place. and what's called a two-tier busing start time schedule. And that led to quite a few busing issues and ultimately the decision a couple weeks ago to change start and dismissal times mid-year.
Yeah, a lot of districts around the state are struggling with what's at least part of the problem, what went wrong in Madison. Not enough school bus drivers. So fall school starts, what happens with this new bus plan?
Yeah, on a daily basis, buses were as much as an hour late in the morning or afternoons, and it just wasn't getting better. So it was something with a new bus company in place. There were some anticipated hiccups at the beginning of the year, and from parents I talked to, they were willing to accept some of that as the year began. But as it continued, even a month and a half into the school year, with really no solution in sight, it became clear the problem wasn't just going to get better with time. There was a serious problem with just not enough drivers to staff the routes, and those drivers weren't going to magically appear overnight.
So changing school start times, you know, on a plan with a lot of lead time, that can be a logistical challenge, and it requires a lot of adjustments for people. Now you're talking about changing mid first semester of the school year. Talk about how that shook out.
Yeah, so the district announced it in mid to late October that it would be effective November 6th. Of course, the first day after daylight savings time changes as well. So I know a lot of parents were already having students adjust to sleep schedules, but they had about 2 weeks lead time. And for two elementary schools specifically saw the biggest changes. They moved back actually 50 minutes, so nearly an hour. They started later than they had been when the year began. Another about 21 elementary schools moved 5 minutes earlier on start and dismissal time, so a pretty small change. And then a few middle schools also moved back 20 minutes. And the big concern with that wasn't necessarily the fact that they moved 20 minutes, it was that moving 20 minutes meant they weren't going to get dismissed until 4:30 now. And with the time change and obviously winter ahead, that means that sometimes students will be leaving in the dark already, middle school students. And so that has concerned some parents as well.
Yeah, 50 minutes even may not sound like a lot, but you talked to some teachers and parents who had kind of made plans for how this school year is going to work. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, you know, families settle into routines, and I think that's something parents and teachers stress to me is for children especially, those routines can be really important to sort of settle them in, and they know how the day is going to operate so they can focus in on the things they're at school to do. And when you disrupt that by almost an hour, not only can it disrupt those sorts of things, but logistically, students are signed up for, you know, swim lessons or what have you, other sports, therapy sessions. There's a lot of different appointments that are made based on school schedules, including parents' work schedules. A lot of times parents will work those out so they could drop their student off or see them off on the bus and be home in time to get them off the bus. And an hour difference, depending on your job, might just not be doable. So there's been some parents who have continued to drop their student off at the same time they were before because they don't have an option. And that just means that student is waiting outside the school longer. And as winter approaches, you know, that's especially concerning. And I also heard from some teachers who have children themselves in schools. And previously, maybe the school schedule worked out that they were going to be able to drop their kid off or pick them up conveniently around their own school schedule, and that suddenly became not true, and they were having to figure that out.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Green Bay. Rich, hi.
Hello. A few years ago, like 2019, Green Bay Public Schools took a good look at this issue, and it looks like they were going to move to later start times, but for a lot of reasons, it just hasn't happened. But one simple idea that I think would be helpful is just to eliminate daylight savings time. A few years ago, the United States Senate actually voted to eliminate daylight savings time, but nothing happened after they did that. But Wisconsin, because we border a time zone, it'd be pretty easy for Wisconsin just to say, we're not going to do daylight savings time.
Rich,
that
I got you, Rich. Thanks for the call. I think that change is above our pay grade, Scott. But Rich points to Green Bay was on a similar path as Madison, it sounded like, starting in 2019. Here comes COVID. This could be a very long process to turn the ship of school start times.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not something generally districts want to spring on people. They want, you know, as I was talking about, there's a lot of planning that families do around school schedules. So schools really want to let parents have the time to figure out what it's going to mean for their out-of-school lives to change those times. And this was just a situation where district officials have said they didn't have any other options. Otherwise, buses were going to continue to be an hour or more late, and that meant students missing instruction, and that was in a lack of predictability for families. So they decided that the headache of doing it sort of last minute was better than continuing the situation as it was unfolding.
And Scott, as we wrap up, this change just happened, I think, a week ago or so. I know it's still early, but are things running better now?
So according to some data the district got from the bus company and shared with me at the end of last week, it did look like on-time buses, the measure they use, which is within 10 minutes of the scheduled time, were increasing. So you could say it's better in that way. It still wasn't 100%. You know, I certainly, after that article published, heard from some folks who said, well, my student, that certainly wasn't true for my student. And so it's still not perfect. And so they're still working out some kinks in the system. And, you know, drivers are learning new routes now and tripling up on routes instead of doubling up on routes. So there's still definitely some things to be worked out. But that initial week data did show at least some improvement.
Scott, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Scott Girard, K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times, with us for a look on the latest reporting on the Madison Metropolitan School District's change to start and dismissal times at 27 schools last week after some bus logistical problems. Coming up, a researcher who's been following the issue of school start times will tell us how later start times can affect educational outcomes and sleep patterns and health, especially for teens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would it affect your family if school start times were pushed back? Do you live in a district that's already done this? What's your experience been like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about school start times now with one of the leading researchers on adolescent sleep health and education policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should school start later, especially at the middle and high school levels? How would that affect your family, your school? Join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa Meltzer is a pediatric psychologist and professor at National Jewish Health. She's also the founder of Nyxios Consulting, which provides pediatric sleep solutions for researchers and clinical providers. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the sleep, Lisa, we just heard about some of the logistical challenges. We change school start times. If a district is saying, yes, we want to let kids sleep in a little bit later, what kind of plans do they have to make sure a change goes smoothly?
There are a number of logistical issues with changing start times, but they're all achievable. And so I think that's an important message. Mm-hmm. It changes hard and it feels very daunting. But the issue described here with the school bus drivers is something that a lot of districts have encountered because there's a national shortage on bus drivers. But that's not necessarily the same issue as later start times. Healthy start times, which is at least 8:30 for middle and high school students, are essential to allow students the opportunity to get enough sleep, which helps them with their academic functioning and their overall health and development.
Let's talk about those teenagers, tweens and teens, I think, and their sleep needs. Why is it that they, in particular, could benefit from starting a little bit later?
When adolescents go through puberty, hormones change. And one of those hormones that changes is melatonin. And melatonin is a naturally produced hormone that helps our body to recognize when it's time for going to sleep and when it's time for waking up. And in adolescence, again, going through puberty, the timing of that melatonin gets delayed by about 1 to 2 hours. So even adolescents who would try to go to sleep early, it's very hard for them to fall asleep because their body has physiologically changed. And so by having that trouble of going to sleep early and then on the flip side being awakened very early for an early school start time means that they're not getting enough sleep. And across the country and in my own research, when we have delayed start times for middle and high school students, what we find is that they don't actually end up staying up that much later, but they do sleep significantly later in the morning, on average about 30 to 40 minutes for middle school students and almost up to an hour for high school students, depending on how long the delay is. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but over the course of a school week, I mean, you're looking at somewhere between 2.5 to 4 extra hours of sleep per week, and then you multiply that by all the weeks of the school year, and now you have adolescents who are no longer sleep deprived.
I think this is a huge point, Lisa, because I think a lot of times people look at this situation and say, oh, teens are sleeping in because they're lazy, they're staying up late because they're making bad teenage decisions. This is biology we're talking about, it sounds like.
Correct. This is a physiological, biological change. And it's, I mean, there are other reasons why adolescents stay up. Sure, they've too many extracurricular activities and a lot of homework. And there's always, we can blame technology and social media, but all of these issues have been acknowledged and recognized for over 40 years, long before we all had our phones and technology in the bedrooms. It is a biological issue.
Now, you've mentioned, you've hinted at some of the benefits here. You did, I understand, a 5-year study in Colorado on changing start times and impact on sleep. Can you dig into some of the details? What did you find over the course of that big project?
Sure. So one of our suburban districts here in the Denver metro area with 55,000 students covering a range of 104 square miles. And I mentioned that because of the transportation issues and how long it takes some of the kids to get to school. But they delayed high school start times from 7:10 to 8:20. And they delayed middle school start times from 8 to 8:45. And they moved elementary school start times earlier from 9 to 8. And what we found over the 3 years of data that we collected, plus focus groups and teachers, is that students, as I said, in middle school and high schools didn't go to bed later, but they slept later and they got more sleep. And in our nation, about 25% of adolescents are getting sufficient sleep duration. And by changing school start times in our district, we now had about 65% of adolescents getting enough sleep. So just that one change made a huge difference. But what we also found were changes to attendance and how engaged students were. Teachers got more sleep. Parents of middle school and high school students got more sleep. Students in elementary school who started an hour earlier, their actual sleep duration didn't change that much. So those are younger children who haven't gone through the biological changes and can wake up slightly earlier for those earlier start times. And in our focus groups, we found lots of positive benefits that aren't always tangible, such as students saying, it's really nice to go to school once the sun is up, right? Because these are kids who are going to school in the dark and getting home in the dark. They had more energy. Parents are describing their kids are no longer zombies, that they enjoyed talking to them. Kids are eating breakfast. So lots of different changes.
Talking to Lisa Meltzer, a pediatric psychologist, professor at National Jewish Health, looking at school start times and kids' sleep, especially teenagers' sleep. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Claire on Facebook, who writes, my child attended a private school in Chicago that recognized the biological differences in children at different ages and adjusted the school day start time so that younger children started earlier. The high school classes started later around 9 a.m. Sounds like Claire appreciated that change. Are you seeing, Lisa, more and more schools, public and private, starting to do what Claire's kids' school did?
Absolutely. So in Colorado, a number of our districts have changed. This year, the Denver Public Schools, our largest district, has implemented these healthy changes. The state of California actually passed a law that the implementation got delayed because of COVID, but finally went into effect, where middle schools are not allowed to start before 8 a.m. and high schools are not allowed to start before 8:30. And that's a statewide mandate. Other states have been following up with similar types of legislation. Florida just recently passed it. And then school districts, as we know, are locally controlled. And so there's a number of districts across the country, large districts and small districts, that have implemented this. And then even more districts that continue to study whether or not this is beneficial, which we know it is.
A common objection, I think, Lisa, is for kids who have after-school extracurricular activities, clubs, sports teams, what have you. If the school end time gets later, all of a sudden those things are starting to run into dinner time at home. Is that an objection that you've encountered?
You definitely see some delays there. In our district, one of the things they did was they decided to have shorter practices because the students were well rested. And so if you have shorter practices where the students are more engaged, those are actually more effective than longer practices with sleep deprived athletes or extracurricular, you know, the different activities. In our research, we found that participation did not significantly decline. And another objection parents often put forth is that students need to work after school. And what we found was that students from low income backgrounds, their actual employment didn't change. And in fact, the number of students or percent of students employed went up with the later start time. So it didn't have a negative impact on either activities, athletics, or after school employment.
Our caller earlier, when we were talking to the Madison reporter, mentioned the idea of daylight savings time being part of our problem. I understand that's something you've looked and thought about, Lisa. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that people are tired of switching. They don't want to go back and forth from daylight saving time to not to standard time. But people have this misperception that we need to stay on permanent daylight time because in the summer, our days are long and everybody feels like if we stay on permanent daylight time, our winter days will be long. But the thing is that they won't. Our days get shorter in the winter because that's just the way the earth rotates. We need to be on permanent standard time because that allows for light in the morning and darkness in the evening. And that light in the morning is what tells our brains to stop making melatonin and wake up. And the darkness in the evenings is the cue to our brains to make melatonin and prepare for sleep. So the caller was right, a permanent standard time is actually the most healthy way to approach sleep and wake for everybody, no matter how old.
We heard from Cody on Facebook who writes, why does the school day not follow normal work hours? Most households don't have a parent at home full time. The tricky thing there, I guess, is what is normal work hours? I don't know if most people even do 9 to 5 anymore. Should the standard work schedule be part of the discussion here, though, Lisa?
I think that, as you pointed out, there is no more standard work schedule. I do think schools need to be cognizant of the variety in work schedules. I think especially at the elementary school level, having activities that students can participate, especially low cost or free activities for working families, so they don't have to pay for before or after care. In our district, we found that before school care basically disappeared once we moved elementary schools from 9 to 8, but the number of students in after school care doubled. So a number of schools came up with activities. They partnered with the Boys and Girl Club or the YMCA to have free and low-cost activities for students to participate in until parents were done working.
Lisa, if there's a parent out there listening whose kids still have that early start time or a district administrator pondering this, what do you suggest to start the process, to start the conversation, to move a district to bump those start times back?
I think it is a conversation. I think before districts change, they need to engage with the community and find out what the concerns are. Find out things like middle school parents are concerned that their kids won't get on the bus. So can middle schools open for breakfast and study hall so parents can still drop those kids off and get to work on time? I think, you know, there's things that districts can do to engage the community to make sure that this change, which is an important and positive one, also works for the members of the community. I think parents in the interim need to help their students have very consistent sleep-wake schedules. So not letting them stay up really late and sleep in on the weekends, that makes it very difficult then for those students to go to bed early and wake up early on school days. So I think there's immediate things that families can do and then broader conversations that districts need to be having between the administration and the families to make this successful.
And at the center of this, Lisa, again, is how important sleep is for a teenager's health. In our just last half a minute or so, could you hammer that point home?
Absolutely. When kids get enough sleep, they do better in school. They have better physical and mental health. We know there's very strong ties between sleep and mental health. We know that their overall quality of life improves. We know that when students don't get enough sleep, it's tied to weight gain. It's tied to depression. It's tied to poor physical functioning and social interactions. And so sleep is essential. It is an essential biological feature that everybody needs to be at their best.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Meltzer is a pediatric psychologist and professor at National Jewish Health. She joined us for a look at why schools around the country are considering later start times, especially at the high school and middle school levels, and how school start times affect student health and educational outcomes. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's so common we take it for granted. The humble switch that turns on our lights and so many other things. Trace the complicated history behind that everyday technology with the author of the new book, The Switch. Tomorrow morning at 8:30 here on the Ideas Network. On our last edition of Food Friday, we had a great conversation about soup with lots and lots of practical advice. A lot of you called in with your favorite recipes and ingredients. We heard from some more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jacqueline says her soups are mostly turkey or chicken noodle, beef, veggie, or chili in rotation. Is chili a soup? That's probably not an argument I want to start. James says lentil soup is a good one for me. If you want meat, some cut up smoked sausage pairs nicely. And Dale says turmeric. I put it in every soup I make. I'm there with you, Dale. I don't put it in every soup, but sometimes it's like this soup has no color. It is like a colorless soup. I'll add turmeric or a little bit of sweet paprika. Neither of them adds a ton of flavor all by himself. You don't go overboard with it, but they add a ton of color. Keep your soup suggestions coming over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.